Former Long Island Congressman Steve Israel has traded in a political career for one as an author, but the politics have not been discarded completely, especially as the issue of guns in America continues with massive demonstrations led by the teens who survived the shooting at their high school in Parkland, Florida in February. In his new novel, Big Guns, the gun lobby controls the political direction of the U.S., requiring that every American over the age of 4 years old carry a gun. What ensues is a discomforting, hilarious indictment of the current state of American politics. The novel is set in a fictional town on Long Island that becomes ground zero for a pitched battle over gun rights and gun control. Its author, Steve Israel, represented New York's 3rd congressional district as a Democrat until he decided not to run again in 2016, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Joe.
Why skewer the gun lobby?
If there's anybody who needs to be skewered, I would say it would be them. You know, I spent 16 years in the United States Congress, and in those 16 years, there were 52 acts of mass gun violence. And so, you know, I sat in Congress during the shooting at a theater in Aurora, Colorado, during the shooting at a church in Charleston, during the shooting of a campus in Virginia, Virginia Tech, and during the shooting of an elementary school in Connecticut, Sandy Hook. And after every single one of those shootings, the number one question that I and most of my colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, faced was, when is Congress going to do something? Don't do everything, just do something. And I decided to write a book answering that question in the best way I know, which is satirical and snarky and from absolutely the inside of the United States Congress.
And the thing about the book is that it seems outrageous, although what we're reading about every day seems outrageous.
Yeah.
So how do you, and this is a question of, there's a writer you are often compared to as Carl Hiaasen, and I know I've talked to him about this, of how do you out satire satire?
It's such a good question, and it's a real debate right now in literary circles. And the debate is satire on hiatus right now, because every day seems to be a living satire in American politics. You know, left and right, doesn't matter. It's just so sensational and seems so absurd that it really is hard to write satire and to write it in a way that is believable, because the reality is unbelievable. And that was tricky during the writing of Big Guns. You know, I was writing about a very serious subject, but I found the only way I could make it accessible and have people understand what's happening behind the scenes in Congress is to do it in a satiric way. But finally, on this question, you know, the world's best satirist, and I would never put myself in this category, but the world's best satirist always found a way to use satire to expose absurdity on serious subjects. So Joseph Heller in Catch-22. I mean, what could be more serious than World War II? And Mark Twain on slavery. And so I'm honored to be part of that genre, although I don't claim to have the same level of talent.
When it came to writing the book, though, I mean, you lived a lot of this, right? I mean,
yeah.
you knew a lot of this from the inside. Normally, I would ask the question about research, but you were living this day to day.
My research was just showing up to committee hearings. And my research was sitting on the floor of the House listening to my colleagues defend the gun lobby. And my research was listening to my colleagues talk not about the survival of their constituents in a school, but their survival in the next election, which depended on the gun lobby. And I wrote on my iPhone. I mean, literally, I would take my iPhone out of my pocket when I observed something or heard something and begin writing it. And I just wove those moments into Big Guns.
What is it about the power of that gun lobby that you think we as Americans should be concerned about?
Here's what Americans should be concerned with, and I can answer your question by sharing real life in Congress. I spent 2 days in meeting in the Appropriations Committee where we offered amendments like no fly, no buy. If you're deemed too dangerous to fly on a plane, you shouldn't be able to buy a military-style assault weapon. We offered amendments for stricter and stronger background checks. All of those amendments were defeated. At the end of this process, my colleagues and I loaded into the members-only elevator. When the doors to the members-only elevators close, it's an inner sanctum. There's no press, there's no staff, there are no tourists. And I heard many of my colleagues, Republican members of Congress, say that they were ashamed with themselves for voting that way. They were uncomfortable voting against these amendments, but had to do it because they didn't want to face the wrath of their gun voters. That is what is driving this political dynamic. And I think it may change now as a result of the Parkland students, but that's what people need to know, that you have members of Congress who are more concerned with their political survival in a primary than the survival of their constituents.
You mentioned the Parkland students, and what they have done is so impressive and so important. Mm-hmm. But do you think it is enough to cripple a lobby that is so powerful and so filled with money and power?
First of all, I hope so. And secondly, I think it's possible, but only for the next 6 months. We're going into a midterm election where the majority of the House of Representatives is at stake. If the current majority wins, you will never see even a debate over no fly, no buy or universal background checks. If the majority changes, you will see those measures reach the floor of the House. What will be the determining factor are these students. When I used to chair the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, so I think I have a good sense of what changes the game in an election. When students are talking to their parents about a congressional election, specifically centered on the issue of who's going to vote for universal background checks, that changes the narrative. When students bring their parents to the polls in an election instead of parents bringing their children to the polls, that changes the dynamic. So it is possible that this student movement will change the conversation, which changes the election, which changes the House, which changes the law.
Were the conversations that you heard as a congressman different behind closed doors than they were on the floor, meaning that there was an understanding that something had to be done?
It's a great question again. I heard two types of conversations from members of Congress who generally opposed any bill that would reduce gun violence. One was the hardcore conversation, and it was based on their true belief that the Second Amendment is an absolute that protects people's right not just to bear arms, but bear any arms they want without background checks, without regulation, without any hindrances. And then I heard the belief that I shared with you on the members' elevator, members of Congress who wanted to vote for some compromise but felt that they couldn't because of the politics back home. I, frankly, have more respect for the first than the second. I have more respect for somebody who believes, in their soul that the government can't regulate guns than somebody who votes one way but knows better. And those are the two conversations that I heard. And hopefully there will be more members of Congress who are willing to take some risk to compromise at the end of the day in the next Congress.
As of right now, do you think the NRA is as powerful as it was a year ago?
I would say no, as a specific result of Parkland. In fact, I can quantify it. In most public polling that I've seen, the top three issues usually are taxes, the economy or jobs, and security. And now, in recent polling that I've seen, the issue of gun violence is popping into that top three. If that's sustained, if the issue of gun violence is one of the top three concerns that voters have, continues through the election, I think that the gun lobby will find itself in big trouble, and good common sense things are going to pass despite their efforts.
You announced your retirement from Congress well before it became a cool thing to do.
Right.
Now everybody's doing it.
Everybody's doing it.
But there had to have been there had to have been some relief when President Trump was elected, and you thought to yourself, oh, well, thank God I wasn't a part of that.
Well, Joe, you know, I used to tell interns and volunteers and other young people that in politics, timing is everything, including when to time your exit from politics. I got out at exactly the right time. And frankly, I realized in this environment of gridlock, I'd never be able to write a law that would pass. So instead, I've decided to write books that I hope will influence people and legislators.
Do you understand? I assume I know the answer to this question, but
yeah.
Do you understand why, on both sides of the aisle, so many longtime representatives are leaving their posts?
Yes, I do. I mean, look, I decided to leave after 16 years because I couldn't stand to get into another cubicle and beg another human being for another dollar to support my campaign. I had had it with fundraising, which has broken the system, despite the best motivations and intentions of many of our lawmakers. For others, I think a lot are getting out just because they can't stand the fundraising and the gridlock, and the fundraising, the gridlock, and the screaming. And in this cycle, you're seeing a record number of senior Republican members get out just because they're smart, and they see the handwriting on the wall. They know that it's going to be a tough election. They will end up in the minority, and so they've decided not to wait for that contingency, but to go out on their own terms.
But you would have thought that this 2 years would have just been like making hay for congressional Republicans, because you have a Republican House, you have a Republican Senate, you have a Republican president. What happened?
Well, you may have a Republican president, but you know, he is his own brand. You know,
right.
So you have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, you have a Republican president who really is not a Republican president, but a Trump president. You know, he presides over the Trump Party. You have a president who vilifies his own members. You have a Congress that is run by Republicans that can't get anything done other than a tax bill that many Americans are still trying to figure out the benefits of. And the final thing, Joe, is that no matter – we're in this polarized environment where no matter how conservative you are, you're not conservative enough. No matter how progressive you are, you're not progressive enough. And the middle is beginning to collapse. In that environment where you're getting yelled at everywhere you go, you know, a lot of my colleagues, former colleagues, have decided, you know, I might as well leave the place and try another line of work. I hope they don't try writing, because most of them, you know, are qualified to write their memoirs, but not particularly a novel.
What is it about the position? I've wondered a lot about this. Of do you think that there is an understanding that a fundamental change has to happen, meaning that people who are leaving, we can say we understand
yeah.
why, but that fundamental change is ultimately needed for this gridlock to somehow crack open?
Not only do I understand it, but I have two ways of achieving it, he said modestly. there are two things that we should do that would almost immediately correct the state that we're in. One is we should eliminate the process of gerrymandering in America that creates congressional districts to protect incumbents. As a result of gerrymandering, you've got districts that are mostly far to the left and far to the right, which means those incumbents, they don't fear a general election. They fear being primaried from the farther right and the farther left. And so that just pulls them to the extreme of issues and punishes them for compromise. We ought to have nonpartisan redistricting, no gerrymandering. You draw a district so that it contains roughly the same number of people, and you don't pack the left or the right into a district. And then the second thing we need to do is just end the influence of money on politics. It's gotten to the point where a member of Congress in a competitive district in an expensive media market has to spend 30 hours a week raising money. And 30 hours a week raising money is 30 less hours spent dealing with job creation, middle class growth, infrastructure, health care, foreign policy, national security.
So you ultimately served two different districts, right? The second and third district in
yeah.
New York. Because of the gerrymandering, did your constituency change dramatically?
It did not. And part of the reason for that is that we really don't have, believe it or not, we don't have at least in the last redistricting process in 2012, didn't have political redistricting. It was actually done by a court. And as a result of that, my district on Long Island, all the districts on Long Island, and many districts throughout New York State are right in the middle. You know, I had one of the most moderate districts in the country. It was 50-50. So I always knew that I was pleasing half my district and pissing off the other half in everything I did. But because of that, I had the freedom and the flexibility to find compromises. The problem is in those districts that are 80% Republican or 80% Democratic, where there is no freedom to find compromise. If we had more districts drawn in the middle, then you'd have more compromise and more stuff getting done in Washington, D.C.
The other thing I don't understand is that even though you have a Republican president, and I understand what you're saying and agree with you about the Trump brand, and not a Republican, but a Trump
right.
presidency, but still you have a Republican House, you have a Republican Senate. Do they have the power to speak up a lot more and make more changes, or do they realize they don't have that power, which is why they have been so eerily silent?
Well, look, if they had had, for example, Jeb Bush as the president, or Kasich, or, you know, another conventional Republican, my guess is they would have accomplished a heck of a lot more for several reasons. Number one, they would have had the power to do it. Number two, they would have focused on getting things done. And number three, they wouldn't be in crisis mode all the time. But they've got Donald Trump. Donald Trump, you know, on one day supports something, the next day he opposes it. He is at, you know, his numbers are going up, but his gravity is about 40% favorability. When your president is at 40% favorability as a Republican member of Congress, you're doomed. You know, it's hard for you, for the Republicans to win elections when their brand is at 40%. And so they can't get things done because they're afraid to. They're in a defensive crouch. And that explains why nothing is getting done. They can't afford to abandon Trump, but they can't afford to stick with him. And so the place is absolute mayhem. This will be corrected in 6 months because I believe, although the balloting is the polling is closer today than it was even, you know, last week, I believe that the Democrats have a better than 50% chance to take the House. And that will create checks and balances, and both President Trump, if he's there for another 2 years, and members of Congress will have an incentive to try and get stuff done.
What does it say about us? What does it say about voters? What does it say about the American people that this happened, that this has been allowed to happen?
It says that we, as the American people, are in a moment of time that produced Donald Trump where no moment would have, and before or after. And there are four reasons for that. Number one, the economy is changing radically. And 2008 wasn't just an economic meltdown. It was kind of an economic trauma that affected the American people. Number two, we've lost faith in institutions. You know, institutions used to bind us, whether it was the church or sports or Wall Street, but we've lost faith in institutions. Third, you know, you've got ISIS, you've got gun violence, people are afraid of their safety. And finally, people think that if you don't have a super PAC and a lobbyist, you don't count anymore in America. You put those four convergences together, and they lead specifically to the election of an authoritarian character like Donald Trump.
How do you feel about, we've been talking a lot about the Republicans, how do you feel
yeah.
about how the Democrats are doing in these last 2 years? You've been a longtime supporter of Nancy Pelosi. There mm-hmm. are people within the party who think it's time for a change. What do you think?
Look, I think that if Democrats expect to win back the House over the next 6 months by campaigning on whether Nancy Pelosi should stay or go, they're going to lose. They can't make this about Nancy Pelosi, and they can't allow the Republicans to make this about Nancy Pelosi. They have to make it about two other things. They have to make it not about what's happening inside the Beltway, but what's happening to families sitting at a kitchen table in Albany, in Schenectady. They've got to make it not about them, but, you know, not about us as Democrats, but about you as voters. And the second thing they need to do is also make this about Donald Trump you know, ask the American people and American voters, do you want to validate this guy's presidency by giving him the continuation of a loyal Republican Congress? those two messages together, I think, are winning messages.
For half of the 16 years that you served in Congress, President Barack Obama was the leader.
Yeah.
It has to be, what does that feel like then to realize that you left at a time when the president is now Donald Trump? That is a very different vibe, isn't it?
It is, but it's also a different vibe from George W. Bush. I recently told him that he's my favorite president that I thought I didn't like. and he hears a lot of that these days.
Sure he does.
This is like nothing else we've ever experienced. For Donald Trump to wake up every morning not thinking about how he helps the American people, but thinking about himself and how he emasculates the legacy of Barack Obama, it's a terrible way to govern. I wish the Republicans, and I say to my friends and my former, they're still my friends, but former colleagues, take back your party. You know, give us a Jeb Bush. I mean, I never thought I'd pine for the days, you know, of wanting somebody like Mitt Romney to run. Not that I would ever vote for the person, but because the person represented a certain set of values that were, you know, not crazy. So it's tough to see what's happening, but it has nothing to do with Barack Obama. It has to do with the difference between governing appropriately and intelligently and smartly and governing to tear the place down.
But to go back to the earlier question about the just looking at where we are with when I was asking about Nancy Pelosi, do you believe that Democrats are doing enough right now of screaming and yelling about what's happening?
Well, look, I don't think it has to be screaming and yelling. I mean, look, it's important to resist what is happening, but you also have to offer people a blueprint that will change the lives that they're living or the jobs that they have or provide them with some sense of security and stability into the future. So yelling is understandable, but you've also got to show the American people, this is what we're going to do. We're going to make college more affordable, and here's how we're going to do it. We're going to rebuild infrastructure so you're not sitting in traffic. Those are the things that Democrats should be talking about in a very local and customized way.
Well, the name of the book is Big Guns. It is a novel. You read this thing and you just think, man, you must be a really fun person to have a beer with.
Anytime. Okay. Pay for the beer.
Excellent. Always. Steve Israel, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with
you,
us.
Sir.
Thank you. Again, Steve Israel is the author of the new book, Big Guns, a novel. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.